Okay, I know everybody wants to compare notes, just like I'm doing sitting here. However, we need to move on to the next session, and we will get the report back from Materiality in an hour or so. So chairs, if you... Sorry, I shouldn't say this, Sue, but chairs, if you haven't got your presentation or thoughts ready, you're allowed to do it in the next hour or so. So have we got... We're missing a few people. Are they all from the same group? No? Okay, I think that we will start. So the next session, again, and we have Gary and Sue, welcome to this session. You won't have heard, obviously, the discussions that we've had earlier today, but I think it would be fair to say that it seems as though our overall agenda today is all interlinking, and that we have, if you like, referred to the session a couple of times in some of the discussions that we've had. So it will be a very interesting discussion and presentation from you, and hopefully then contribution from the Advisory Council. So I'm not sure who's going to lead this off. Ian's going to lead it off, so I will hand over to you.
Actually, we haven't rehearsed this, so I hope I'm supposed to be...
So he's it. Just grabbing the limelight.
That's right. So I'll go through the important slides, which are numbers 2 and 3, and set out that what we're going to do is have a look at the background to this topic, talk about integrated reporting, the corporate reporting dialogue, the enhanced disclosure task force, and then what's our role in all of this. So turning to slide 3, the Council discussed the future of corporate reporting in February 2014. I might say, as a comment on the side, when we did the agenda consultation last time, one of the questions asked was whether we should have some time for blue sky thinking, and that would have incorporate some of these big questions, I think. And our constituents came back almost to a man and woman saying, no way, don't get involved in blue sky thinking, it's terribly dangerous. So it was a really interesting reaction, and it was quite strong. Anyway, we'll have another go at it at the next agenda consultation, see if we can do better. And that was advised, as it says there, advised to keep an eye on developments, but don't lead them. So then we'll talk through some of these developments, and we'll begin with Alan on integrated reporting.
Thanks, Ian. Perhaps they were scared what we might think in our blue sky thinking. I'm just going to just give you a brief overview from... I'm a member of the Working Group on Integrated Reporting Council, and I'll give you an overview and reminder of what integrated reporting is all about. And later we'll actually come sort of draw it together and talk about our continued interaction with the Integrated Reporting Council, for example. So slide 5, just as a reminder, this is the definition out of the framework in terms of what integrated reporting is. And again, it's basically an integrated report to explain to providers of financial capital how an organisation creates value over time. I think what's important is what's not in there more than anything else to me. When this first emerged as an initiative, I think it was quite largely driven by people with environmental issues in the back of their minds. And the word sustainability was more about sustainable from an ecological or the environmental perspective. And what this has morphed into, and it's been quite heavily debated and hotly debated at both the Council and the Working Group, is what we mean by sustainability. So really this is more of a case of, is an entity's business model sustainable? So can they keep continuing on the same way that they do? Now, there are some environmental examples that are often used to illustrate that, and it's things like if you have a just-in-time inventory system that relies on delivery, for example, of car parts on the day that you're actually constructing them, and you get more frequent storms, for example, as I've had in the eastern seaboard in the US, how does that affect your model? Do you need to think about how environmental changes perhaps should affect or the way you manage your risks, for example? So it's quite a general sustainability issue. The other thing that's important too is that this is clearly a report for investors. Again, this has been an issue that's been debated quite heavily within the Working Group and at Council about whether this is supposed to serve a very wide purpose, and that is it's supposed to meet the needs of many people from different perspectives, And it's come down in the definitions and the framework itself that it's mainly for investors. So in a way, it's kind of got the same sort of focus as we have for financial reporting. Now, if we go to the next slide then, essentially, how does it relate to us? As I said, it's got the same audience. What's slightly different here is potentially a broader range of factors that you have to look at. And I've drawn there, and it's a quote out of the framework itself, is that it identifies within the framework six capitals that they think are important in terms of a sustainable organisation, or the way you sustain your business model or create value. And the six capitals that listed there are financial, manufactured, intellectual, human, social relationship, and then natural. And one of the points that's very important to me is that not all of these capitals have to be presented on. It depends on what's material to your organisation. I often use the IFRS Foundation, even though it hasn't got an investor focus. But if you think about the IFRS Foundation, and if we were to prepare an integrated report, I don't think I'd spend a lot of time on natural capital, because as an organisation, the only thing that we might think we do is we fly around the world a little bit, so we've got a bit of a carbon footprint in terms of flying, but in the scope of things, it's relatively minimal. In the same way, we haven't got much in the way of manufactured capital. What's really important for us, and I suspect people interested in, is our financial sustainability. What's our model for income, for example? That's perhaps one of the risks you're going to discuss tomorrow. We've got some from commercial. We have this conflict between commercial sale of our intellectual property and creating, essentially, standards in the public interest. Then we have money coming in from governments. We have the risks that go with money coming in from private organisations and the perceptions that creates. So a lot of our financial risks, is our revenues model sustainable? In the same way, intellectual capital. I think you'll have a look at some of that tomorrow with the risks. A lot of our intellectual capital is the standards we create, the taxonomy that we create and manage. We've got the human capital side. I think the most valuable people, of course, are the staff in terms of creating the standards. And how do you manage those? And in a report, you'd look at how you maintain and your continuing supply, basically, of good people coming into the organisation to keep on working on standards. And the other one that's important for us is social and relationship, because the equivalent for us is probably how we get on with Europe and the US and Asia and Oceania and so on, all the regulators and all the other parties that we have within broader IFRS community. And people are interested in understanding how we maintain those relationships, how we improve those relationships, and how all of these things relate together. Because the important thing is not taking a thread and saying, here's our financial performance, here's some information about IP, here's some information about, and so on. It's actually how it's all integrated. And that's why the IFRS example is a kind of easy one, because you think about our revenue flows and look at our commercial sales, we have a natural tension there between the value of our intellectual property, our social and relationship responsibilities as a public interest provider, and then trying to generate revenue through selling the stuff we create in the public interest. So we have trade-offs there. And it's understanding the trade-offs and understanding how these are integrated that's very important. That's the theme of an integrated report. And simply you take that to a company situation. People are trying to understand how they create value, how they can continue to create value, and whether that value creation is sustainable in the long term. Now, some people will be affected more by natural features than others. Others will be affected, for example, more by the intellectual property, the vagaries of that going up and down. And it could be that some have got, and I hate to use real examples, but there was a case here in the UK of basically a company selling handsets that lost two contracts and essentially went out of business. And the way you manage those relationships is very important to sustaining your business model. I think the other thing that's particularly important to me is that no matter which organisation you look at, and if you were to tick off and identify which capitals you think might be more important or material to an organisation, I think you'll probably find that financial sits there in just about every organisation that you assess. We describe it in the integrated reporting framework as one of the pillars I always joke with the integrated reporting people that rather than being one of the six pillars that they draw, it should be the big fat central pillar, because I think everybody's got financial reporting. And then the other aspects are around supporting the financial reporting side of it as well. So just to recap then, we, as you'll see when we do the wrap-up, we're interested in financial reporting for investors, so is integrated reporting. The difference is two things. One is the range of different factors, or capitals as they call them, that you might report on in an integrated report. And secondly, integration, or the relationships between those. So if you push down in one, what happens with one of the other capitals is critical to that as well. And I guess while we're on the theme of disclosure earlier today about length, understandability and so on, these reports are supposed to be much higher level. So you imagine, as by way of parallel, if you're reading an annual report and looking at MD&A or management commentary, the upfront director's summary, that's the sort of thing that people suggest is an integrated report, so it's a much higher level. Underneath that, you might end up having, for example, a sustainability report, some financial report, and so on. But they're the pillars that hold up the integrated report. I found it fascinating when we talk about this that a lot of people still think this comes back to sustainability from the environmental space. And I just keep on re-emphasising to people that's not the territory that they're working in. So that's at least a brief overview of where I think integrated reporting is heading as well. And I think Sue is going to talk. Oh, sorry, Gary. This is the corporate reporting dialogue.
Hi, good afternoon. If we start with slide 8. Now, the corporate reporting dialogue I would characterise as a nice development, but one few people know very much about, in part because it only started and went live in June of this year. But by way of a little background, the IARC organized it. The first meetings were last December, and through some formative meetings and stuff, it was actually officially launched this June. The ISB, we were involved in it from day one, one of the first groups that the IARC called on it. And so we've been involved in its creation, the design intent, and what its initial objectives would be. Now, the IARC provides the secretariat, but the design intent is the corporate reporting dialogue group is independent of the IARC, and it was sort of viewed as a bit of a conflict of interest or self-promotion of the IARC in it. So therefore, it's separate, but, you know, not too far away from it. The end of the day, it's essentially right now it's a discussion group, is as the word dialogue would imply, but it's designed to represent the coming together of organizations which have the power to shape the corporate, in this case global corporate reporting landscape. And we'll talk in a minute or two or so who's on it. So going to the next slide is what I put here was I lifted from their website, from paraphrasing off their mission statement. And one of the underlying premises is in here is they want people who set global standards to talk to each other. If you're going to paraphrase what they're about, it really is that. And there's certainly a market-driven demand for calls for alignment. Will standard setters work together? If they can't work together to get a common answer, can at least talk to each other. Let me use a couple of case studies that have been out there. In the last 2 years or so, maybe longer, ourselves, the FASB, the PCOB, and the IAASB all worked on going concern issues. Likewise, there's several groups today, including ourselves and others, that are working on materiality. So the feedback that's coming from the marketplace is you're all bumping into each other. You generally have got the same set of questions. You're generally working on the same problem statements. And you're calling on the same people, asking for input from the same person to multiple recipients with the same questions, the same requests for research. And quite frankly, it's getting a bit much. You know, that's sort of the impetus. It's really market-driven. And again, if you can't come up with a common answer, you can at least go to market with a common set of questions, you know, and sort of pick who's the lead and so on. That's the design intent. We certainly want the organizations to share information back and forth on your projects, and they're certainly looking for ways of which your respective frameworks and standards that they can be aligned and rationalized. I mean, if you think of any large corporation, you've got all sorts of people demanding you report on things, and it's one thing at the group level, it's one thing at the regional level, it's another thing at the subsidiary level, and so on and so on, and depends on who your legal regulators are, the legal environment, and so on. Ideally, they would also like the members of the CRD to express issues with a common voice and go to visit with regulators together, you know, on when there's issues that you need to work together on. So if we go to the next page, the first thing we had to decide was who's going to be on the CRD. And you can, I won't read the list, you can see who's on it, but I'll talk a little bit for about who's not on it. Is one thing we decided is that regulators would not be on it. This will be people who write standards that are either legally required to be followed. You know, for example, U.S. public companies must follow the FASB's rules. The FASB is not a regulator per se, similar, you know, to ourselves and so on. And then there's a list of about 40 organizations that were considered for potential membership. The most of which, quite frankly, I had never heard of, but some of the ones that were on the initial list that were processed as not making it. The World Intellectual Capital Initiative, the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, the Natural Capital Declaration, the list went on and on. They didn't make it for various reasons, some of which weren't truly global enough, or it was a niche reporting initiative, or if it was so voluntary to the point where no one was actually doing it, and so on. They all had legitimacy beyond the initial list, but we culled it down to the list that you see in the paper, that these the organizations that we think globally have the most impact on corporate reporting. If we go on to the next slide, is... Again, this is a lift out of the Corporate Reporting Dialog webpage, and it sort of leads into the initial deliverables, because at the moment, other than getting organized, there have been no deliverables. But the corporate reporting landscape, the sense is probably all information feeds into the public domain probably come from one of these six pillars. And broadly, almost anything can be fit inside one of them. On the far left, ourselves and the FASB sort of make sense for financial and manufacturer, the International Standards Organization, and the list, you know, goes on. I won't go through them. Some of the organizations, such as ourselves, you have legal authority to do it. Others, it's just voluntary, but like Global Reporting Initiative, it's really caught on. And actually on GRI, we learned recently, they're actually legally required in about 23 countries in one form or another. They're worked into legislation or regulation. So as you stare at that chart, if we go on to the next slide, what are our short-term deliverables? And the first one that we want to do is basically what are all the arrows between those different groups? I mean, who are the standard setters under each of those six pillars? Who writes standards for what purpose and how does it affect whom? So it's whether it's a matrix and or just lines or key dependencies or who's sort of first in line, who's, you know, at the end of the line and who's more of a leader and a follower. And who are the stakeholders from that? Who's the customer? In some cases, it's regulators. Other cases, it's investors and other users, and so on. And the goal is to, once we sort of got that schematic done, is start aligning who the stakeholders are with their frameworks and their networks. The project plan approved last week was that the goal is the CRD members will give our input as to, you know, again, the lines of the prior chart, you know, by the end of this month, first draft early in November, with an approval and publishing by the end of the year. The other decision was that whatever the final product is, it becomes owned by the IRC. Then once that is done, the second of the two initial deliverables is, okay, now that we've got that, what do we do with it, and how do we engage with the various corporate participants who actually have to do the work, you know, that feeds into it? That's aspirational at the moment because it hasn't started. I think it's dependent upon getting the first mission done. So if we go on to the last slide, just before I summarize, a couple of weeks ago I went to Madrid for the IIRC has a major pilot program for a couple hundred companies were there who have done the initial pilot programs for integrated reporting, and it was sort of their first group meeting for feedback and where are we going from here and problems and how they resolved and so on. I was on the corporate reporting dialogue panel. Just sort of paraphrase, I'm just reading the meeting minutes, and it was a 3.5-day conference. I would probably paraphrase that the participants had a strong strategic voice for global standardizations of reporting standards and everything, basically with the goal to hopefully reduce the reporting burden. There was also strong support for one global common set of accounting standards, so gratifying to our organization to hear that. And then I think tactically in terms of if I just sort of counted the number of comments on per subject, say the tactical level, focus on the definition of materiality and how you would apply materiality into this reporting. Corporate reporting dialogue, I don't think it's intended to be a forever type thing in terms of deliverables, but I think it's intended to be forever in terms of the key decision makers reporting to get together regularly, you know, share, compare notes, sort of try to find a way to rationalize your work and minimize the overlaps. Hopefully the initial deliverables are out by the end of this year. So with that, I'll stop, take questions or wait to the end.
We'll do everything at the end, I presume, yes. Okay, I want to move on now to talk about some specific initiatives focused really on the banking industry that I have some involvement with. I'm looking first at the Enhanced Disclosure Task Force, which is on page 15. So some of you in this room I know are very familiar with the Enhanced Disclosure Task Force, so you'll have to bear with me a little bit so I can fill in information for others. And this is really a private sector group that was initiated by the Financial Stability Board back in May 2012. So it's still relatively new. And what's quite unique about this group is it brings together into one forum users of financial statements, preparers, and the audit firms. And really the objective, I think, of the Enhanced Disclosure Task Force when it was established in 2012 was to try and find a way to improve transparency around banks with a view to rebuilding confidence in the markets post the crisis. And it's an interesting group where there's a bit of a discussion about what investors might like to see and an exchange between what they'd like and what the banks might consider as appropriate or feasible with some input from the audit firm. So it's a bit of live due process. Now, their overall objective is to try and improve risk disclosures of banks, and the way they've gone about it is slightly different to IFRS. It's a set of recommendations, so seven, I think, fundamental principles of risk disclosures and 32 more specific recommendations on different areas of risk. And it's a voluntary regime, essentially, with a recommendation to make disclosures that can be provided in different places, either in the audited financial statements, in MD&A, or in the Pillar 3 risk disclosures provided as part of the Basel requirements. So what I wanted to touch on the next slide was what's similar and different between what they do and what we do and how do we interact. The first difference, obviously, between the EDTF and what we do is the fact that it's so industry-specific. It really is focused on disclosures for banks, which means it hones in on very specific things. And one interesting thing they do is they use quite a lot of templates. So it's less objective-based in its approach ultimately than a lot of IFRS, which I guess is partly because it's such a specific focus on one industry. When the EDTF was first developed, it was really very much designed to be complementary to the IFRS requirements. So if you look at IFRS 7, it's very much objective-based. And the idea with the EDTF recommendations was that it built on a number of the objectives in IFRS 7 and really fleshed some of them out a bit and made them more specific with the needs of the market in mind. So it was designed to complement rather than replace our requirements. And one thing that the EDTF has been set up with in mind is to be responsive in case of need. So because it's less formal in the sense that it's not written into legal requirements in different jurisdictions, but rather it's a set of recommendations, and because it's a smallish group of people without a comment letter process, it's designed to be responsive. If particular information needs arise in the market, I think the idea is that this group could be convened relatively quickly to come up with timely recommendations to be acted on quickly by preparers. Even though these are just recommendations, they have been supported by regulators in different jurisdictions, which has led to different approaches in different parts of the world. So, for example, in Canada and in the UK, the bank regulators have very much encouraged their banks to apply the requirements. And like us, the general theme of the EDTF, like our disclosure initiative, is really to try to improve communication. What we have tried to do when we've come along with new IFRS post the EDTF, so for example in our new impairment disclosure requirements that we've just added to IFRS 7, we've looked at the EDTF disclosure recommendations and tried where we can to pick up similar themes with the hope that preparers could perhaps use similar disclosures to meet both sets of requirements to reduce overlap. So moving now to our actual ISB involvement with the EDTF. So we're not a formal member of EDTF. As I said, that's made up of users, preparers and audit firms, but we've been an industry representative member of the EDTF. So we go along to their roundtables and have an opportunity to contribute in those forums. And similarly, with Basel overhauling the Pillar 3 disclosure requirements for risk at the moment, we are a working group member, so we come along and provide some input on the Pillar 3 requirements. And I think that involvement has been important, at least from my personal perspective, for a number of reasons. One of the things I think that we need to be mindful of with the interaction between IFRS and these very industry-specific approaches is to try and manage the perceived information overload that investors might have to deal with if IFRS is merely writing requirements and separately there's specific industry-specific requirements being drafted. And also, I think, not just overload, I think there's a risk of duplication or slightly different cuts of the same information being provided to investors that then need extra explanation. So having dialogue between the ISB, the IFRS Foundation, and these different groups means that we're able to try and manage the risk of overlap between our requirements and to try and be as coordinated as possible as we can, given our different sets of requirements. That can be tricky, obviously, because particularly if you're looking at banks and if you're looking at regulatory requirements, the perspectives are slightly different. So the perspective of Pillar 3, for example, is a lot on risk-weighted assets, Tier 1 or regulatory capital requirements, and what's consolidated for regulatory purposes, none of which necessarily ties exactly to what's reported in IFRS financial statements. So that's something quite tricky for us to try and manage. But that just gives you a sense of those initiatives.
So just to wrap up, we think it's clear, although there might be some debate here on the next slide, that our remit is financial reporting. Now, the diagram or schematic here you see, I think we all accept that IFRS financial statements are our space and the domain of the ISB. We think management commentary is clearly within financial reporting, but even then I think there's some debate amongst some standard setters and even amongst some board members about how far we should go with management commentary. It's a practice statement for us. It's not part of IFRS for asserting compliance. So that's what. And then beyond that, there will be some other aspects of financial reporting that we don't cover. It says in our framework, and I think we all acknowledge, that a set of IFRS financial statements is not the only piece of information investors need. They need other information. So it's part of the information set. And so we know that we live in an environment where others have an important role in terms of providing information. Our main focus is on investors and creditors, and it's about providing information that's making decisions about providing resources. So if we go and have a look at the sorts of dialogue and interactions we have with other bodies, we have a look at some of the differences that we have. There'll be, for example, the Integrated Reporting Council, where they have potentially, as I said before, a broader lot of inputs into this and a focus on integration. Now, we worked more formally with them, so we have an MOU, which I think is up, my recollection is up for review at the moment, it was close to. And we've also contributed staff to both the development of the framework and some of the task forces as well. As a matter of interest, their working group is meeting in Paris on Friday, and I think it's our last working group meeting because it's going to be they're winding up with a change in the way they govern and develop the framework. But we continue to work in that particular case because you see some shared initiatives. There's a materiality task force, and we're part of that, as well as the auditing community, and GRI are on that, and so on. So we continue, because we have a common interest in that theme, to work together on it. So, you know, Sue, I think, emphasised more than anything else, this is about duplication. Gary mentioned about shared interest when you've got common questions. The idea is this is a series of dialogues in a way of getting people us to work together. Sue said we're a participant in corporate reporting dialogue. Gary said, I keep giving you too much stuff, you don't look the same. We're a participant in corporate reporting dialogue, and we supported the Enhanced Disclosure Task Force. And Sue also mentioned the Basel Committee in terms of, again, that's a slightly different environment there because that's to do with bank regulation more than anything else. So there's a slightly different objective, but we have some common threads and common overlays, and it's important that we actually talk and discuss those with them. I think the EDTF is a particularly interesting one because of two dynamics. One is when you get changes in a reporting environment and when you go back to our materiality discussion, what's material today might not be material tomorrow and vice versa. So things change over time. If you've got a group of people within an industry, you can actually identify and react more quickly, I think it is, so that people can share and understand what might be important in a particular point in time. So that's very helpful. And the other thing that you can do within an industry group like that is to identify ways to get more consistent or comparable information within that industry. That's something we always struggle with, obviously, as a standard setter, is you're setting standards and you think about formats or the way something might be presented. Well, it might suit one industry but not another. And so working with groups like the Enhanced Disclosure Task Force, I think it complements what we do, doesn't rather than competing with them. As I said, again, one of the purposes of the Disclosure Initiative is to get us to talk together and work together. I'm expecting some feedback in the next half an hour or so on materiality about how important it is we talk to regulators and the auditors to get on the same page in terms of the way we apply materiality. So we see this as just being us being a responsible citizen and talking with people's shared interests and looking at overlaps, looking at gaps and so on where we can work together. So I guess our open question to you is whether the ISB's participation in these initiatives is at the right level. You told us last time, I think it was, that don't be at the bleeding edge, but be at the table. And we're continuing to take this approach, and it's whether you think we should be more active in some areas or perhaps less active. So open to you.
Thank you, team. I think that shows... I guess, as you say, the proliferation of what is going on and very clearly our role in that. And I think the question that is on page, or it's up there on the slide there, and the added bits that Alan has added to that, definitely seeking our advice. And I think, Christoph, you were the first person. Oh, Isabel, you were first.
Thank you. I think you're at the appropriate level. I think it is necessary to be at the table, and especially when I hear on the corporate reporting dialogue that there needs to be some alignment. You wouldn't want something coming from one of the streams being completely contradicted by what's coming from another stream. So it's very important to be there and to inform each other. The question I have was on, you know, how are you going to be engaging with your own constituents on that particular that particular initiative, you know, for instance, bringing specific topics to the council, whatever you know, other advisory groups you may have. I mean, that's and just a little pointer on the management commentary issue between the difference between standard setters is often linked to their own remit. For instance, in France, it's company law. We have nothing to say. The regulator, the securities regulator does, but as an accounting standard setter, we have nothing to say about it. So it's not our remit. So that's not to say that it's not important, but, you know, that's just a matter of fact.
Christoph?
I think my answer would be that in the short term, the involvement of the ISB is appropriate. It may go further than we think because the alignment across the different reportings may bring significant changes to financial reporting. Some other reporting requirements out there, for instance, go for whenever there is an acquisition for a full retrospective like-for-like reporting, which we don't do. So let's think about if that's aligned. Would we agree to align it on a way that we do a full retrospective alignment on the reporting for acquisition? So the, even short term, the alignment, which sounds a bit like, oh, let's sit together and make sure we don't contradict each other, may go further than we think. In the midterm, I wonder whether the notion of there is financial reporting and then there are the others, which you pointed out with the cycles, whether that is something that will still be the way that people look at it. So will people in 10 years still differentiate? Now, I got a financial report and I got other means of reporting that are somehow separate, because the idea of integrated reporting is to not have that separate anymore. And if that happens, then we've got to ask ourselves what our role is in a world in which these circles don't exist anymore.
I think it's very encouraging to see the ISB, you know, playing the role that it is currently playing, because I think it really boils down to a question of the ISB continuing to remain relevant in this discussion. The integrated reporting, the core reporting dialogue is really happening in response to demand from users for better, you know, high quality information. And to the, if the ISB were to just, you know, continue to work in isolation, I don't think that would be helpful. So I think it's very encouraging to see the ISB working in this respect. I also, you know, in agreement with what Christoph was saying, and I'm happy to hear Sue mention that, you know, the impairment guidance did take, you know, some of the considerations from the EDTF into consideration, because I think that is going to happen. The disclosures that the ISB is propagating will, over time, also need to be responsive to what market participants are trying to get out of the financial reporting. And financial reporting, I think, will always be and should always be a key. It's a fundamental component of the reporting framework and reporting architecture. And with the ISB being involved, that will help to ensure that it remains a fundamental part of it.
Charles.
I'd like to endorse sort of the approach that the ISB is taking. Following the June Council meeting, I had the opportunity of attending the annual conference of the International Corporate Governance Network, which was held in Amsterdam the week after we had our meeting. And the majority of participants there are what could be regarded as the more actively engaged investment community. And they provide very clear feedback that they were getting confused to some extent by this proliferation of standard setters. There was duplication. Many of the bodies that are in this company reporting dialogue participants list are seen as competing with each other. So I think it really is important to maintain the dialogue. But one of the challenges, I think, is that the remit of the ISB is very much financial reporting, and that is, by its very nature, tends to be backward-looking. So it's very relevant to one group of stakeholders, namely those who make investment decisions, by and large, and it helps them in stewardship in particular. some elements of a report, such as the management commentary, may also provide them with some guidance in terms of going forward. But increasingly, we're living in a world where there are multiple stakeholders, and even within the investment community, there are those that I would regard as traditional. They don't really care about ESG. They just make financial judgments and place their bets accordingly in terms of whether they think a particular company will outperform other companies in their benchmark. And then there are others, particularly government funds and union-based funds, who take more of a community, broader stakeholder perspective on their investment responsibilities, and they do look at ESG. And you know, right now, as an illustration, a very topical point in Australia is that a number of these entities are saying, well, we no longer want to invest in companies that have coal mining operations, because coal is dirty, it's polluting the atmosphere, it's contributing to climate change, and eventually it'll be a stranded asset. By voting with their dollars, they will have an impact. At the same time, there are others who want information from companies that are not necessarily using that information for investment purposes, but for other purposes. Typically, you know, they have an activist perspective. They are concerned about one element or other of corporate behaviour. And so there's enormous pressures on companies for information. And I think it's absolutely vital that the ISB have a seat at the table with these bodies, try and minimise duplication, ensure that it retains its primacy as the standard setter for financial information, but recognise that that financial information has to fit into a broader company reporting context. And the biggest risk that I would see for the board in all of this is that technology is changing, societal attitudes are changing, and it's not inconceivable that an entity can become irrelevant despite its strong position today. So I think, given that background, it's vital that the board continue to be involved in the sort of dialogue that it is, and make sure that it has a seat at the table, is aware of what everyone else is doing, and try and ensure that it remains the prime standard setter, particularly for financial reporting. But it could even, over time, I think, be broader than that, given that financial reporting is such an integral part of company reporting.
Thanks, Charles. Thomas?
Well, thank you. This is maybe probably a silly question about the corporate reporting dialogue. I just wonder what would be the, let's say, the outcome of this group? What is the product? Because in the slides, we're talking about initial deliverables by the end of 2014. And I just wonder, let's say I put myself into the position of the ISB and saying, so what is the product? And the group, the dialogue group, decides, okay, we change the accounting in the area of X to get a little bit more climate change into the accounting system. Or resource efficiency is one of the issues which come in Germany, at least, is one of the key issues people are starting to talk about, whether that should be a factor for accounting. So I'm just a little bit puzzled, I must say. That's why probably it's a silly question. What is the outcome of the group? Is it only that somebody looks a little bit more deeper into a specific area, a sector, or is it just the coordination of who does what? Thanks.
Gary?
Short answer is I think it's to be determined. You don't know. And I think the people on the dialogue are probably asking themselves the same question you just did. You're still in, you know, the pre-development stage, if you will. And the first deliver, like I said, is really the network or the maze of all the different dependencies between the groups. Where it goes from there, I don't know. I think the minimum expectation in the marketplace, if you will, is you at least talk to each other and you know what you're doing. But honestly, I just don't know. And I don't think anybody else on the CRD could give you a different answer than I think we'll know it when we get there, but it's a little bit ways out.
Not sure that necessarily helps you, Thomas, but I mean, in some ways I think it is better. However, somebody earlier, I think it was you, Alan, said if you don't know the steps in the journey, or you'll take whatever path that, well, I can't remember what it is, but anyway, I will stop there. Micheline?
Oh. I do agree with that's a good idea to keep stay connected and following what's happening. I guess a word of caution, sometimes when I read these things, it looks like more marketing material than anything else. So I guess it would be for the ISB to stay on what's the portion of this that's more factual and verifiable, as opposed to, what I would call the label the marketing aspect of it, where you can claim a lot of things, but how solid is this, and you don't want to lose your reputation over that.
Thank you for that comment and the others. And I think, and in some ways I think it's quite interesting, generally the feedback has been absolutely agree that involvement is appropriate. And in fact, there has been nobody who has said either you need to be far more involved or far less involved. However, I think, is Micheline, a little word of caution, but also some of the others, I think the key being actually a risk, and again, yes, it might come up tomorrow, about the ISB remaining relevant and therefore absolutely fundamental, we need to be at the table. And I've written down the word flexibility, and I don't think anybody actually used that word, but I wonder whether the ISB's got a think about how nimble and flexible, and I know that that's not, those two words aren't necessarily something that goes with the ISB, around what we can and should do in terms of the, some of the things that Charles talked about in terms of making sure, and Zinger too, in terms of making sure that we do stay relevant. So the starting point is obviously to be involved, but then potentially to say, whoops, or maybe we need to take a slightly different course in order to remain relevant. Anybody, Vincent, would you like to say something?
Just a brief comment. I think I strongly support what's going on in the corporate reporting dialogue, but I had a question more on the disclosures, because in the US you've got the disclosure effectiveness review that's being done. I'm just wondering to what extent are you also thinking about going along the same lines of having dialogue on disclosure effectiveness?
My recollection is that most of the work they're doing in the US is about overlaps between SEC requirements, for example, MD&A and the financial statements. And of course, to Isabel's point, not everybody has that. Some do have the conflict and others don't. We don't have a natural thing that we can look at to take out redundancy in there. And the difficulty is that I think the corporate reporting dialogue might be one space, but I don't think regulators are on that group. And it is mainly about standard setters per se and not some of the regulators. So some of the natural overlaps that you do see, for example, like SEC requirements, wouldn't come out in the corporate reporting dialogue.
Yeah, I think, as I had mentioned, Vincent, it was by design not to have regulators on it, because if you put yourself in their spot, they've got a set of regulations that they themselves, who's at the present table, can't change, doesn't want to talk down the mission of their organizations, which might be in the statutes. And so they have less flexibility in what they can do with their requirements than most of the other organizations at the table. And for that, in general, for that reason, that's why they're not a part of the group.
All right, we might sum up there. And effectively, I think that there is absolutely no doubt that this subject will and should come back to the Advisory Council over the next few years, because I think it will be an ongoing thing. But I think, team, unless you've got any comments to make, you've essentially got the endorsement, if you like, from the Council in terms of advice of continuing to be involved as you are. And I think probably to bring stuff back to us to consider it various points along the journey, because I think it will be a journey, and ensuring that we remain relevant. So thank you very much for that and keeping us up to date, and we will continue to provide you feedback. Okay. In which case, let us